Thanks very much, Martha. That was so interesting. Okay. second speaker. Get going as and when you're ready.
Okay, so thank you. I'd now like to take up this story from another stage, looking at where couples do have children. And I think those women were very right to be worried, actually. here we have a picture of the happy couple. So the happy couple, I was looking around, you know, I thought you can't really have a blank slide at the beginning. But then, you know, as I thought about it and looked through thousands of images on the internet, I thought this couple is a good example, actually. I mean, they are very happy together, aren't they? That is the outcome. They are really happy. They have been married for very many years, and, you know, they've got to this point. But during this journey, they have had many ups and downs. I think we can say that, can't we? So, you know, some of the things that I think are relevant are that when Bill was governor of Arkansas, I think that Hillary, I'm sorry, I am not really so knowledgeable, and I know there are a couple of Americans here, so I'm a bit wary, but I think that Hillary was painted as this sort of Lady Macbeth type figure. She had all this ambition. Bill was the one with the glorious career, in a way. I think that the text was sort of, Hillary should take a bit of a back seat and let Bill get on with it. You know, if it had been the other way around, it could well have been the case that Hillary progressed in politics. But of course, Hillary wouldn't have had the societal support that being a man automatically confers on a person. So, you know, maybe she wouldn't have attained what Bill attained. Hillary now, of course, is free to get on with her career. But she's quite elderly now. People are saying she's frail. She's too frail to be the president. So, you know, the outcome, along that path to the outcome, there have been many ups and downs. So, I wanted to start by thinking about, this is a study of women who had been in professional and managerial jobs and had children. And when they had children, they went back to work, but after returning to work, they decided to exit the workplace. And the reason for conducting this study was to try to understand how organisational factors had impacted on their decision to leave work. So there was a lot of discussion, I think, also in the academic literature about whether it was women's choice. You know, Catherine Hakim was saying women chose to be at home and, you know, it was perfectly okay for them. And then other people were saying, no, it's all about childcare. Women would go to work if there was enough childcare. And we thought that a rather neglected aspect of this departure from work was really about organisations and how women experienced organisations after having children. So that was our primary motivation. We weren't really interested in that study in looking at distribution within the household or looking at what went on within couples. But, you know, somehow when we were trawling through all these quotes and after we had established what went on, what we thought was going on in organisations, women always brought up this topic of their partners, or they always mentioned their partners in some way. And so we felt it was probably important to go back and revisit this topic from really based on what people told us, what women told us. And we couldn't investigate it, we couldn't ask them further questions based on our initial hypothesis because we hadn't set out to look at this. But we did have a lot of material about partners, and not only about partners, but also about male colleagues and how they reacted to women in the workplace. And so we started collect. This is very exploratory work. So we started collecting it together, and some of the theoretical approaches that we are looking at. Of course, there are many different approaches, and I can't really resist giving away the punchline already. But you know, I think that the more I look at all this, I can't really unravel it, and I cannot help thinking that Thomas Kuhn observed that actually, you know, many theoretical approaches are consistent with the empirical data that you get. And I could almost explain my findings through any of these approaches. It really depends on my starting point. And yet, you know, looking at it through any of these vantage points, I think, brings us some deeper understanding. So, Blood and Wolf, a sort of classic sociological approach to looking at relationships, is Blood and Wolf's approach, that it's a relative resource approach, that relative resources determine power. It's the potential ability of one partner to influence the other's behaviour, manifested through the ability to make decisions. So, power is a conceptual focus in conflict theory and is viewed as the individual's ability to control the outcome of decision-making processes. So, determining the outcome, power doesn't have to be experienced as power. You know, it doesn't have to be like in that, there's this awful film about Alexander, maybe I won't go there. So, it doesn't have to be overtly expressed as power, but it can still be powerfully expressed. Bargaining approaches. I started off by looking at all this in my PhD and through an economic approach to decision making and coordination within the household. That's how I became interested in these issues. And, you know, there was a major sort of breakthrough in economics, really, was the development of the bargaining approach, which allowed for conflict as well as cooperation in the household. Gary Becker had started off with this unitary conception of the household, where, you know, by some unknown process, everyone in the household would share a common utility function, and somehow there would be some sort of coordination going on through the work of a benevolent dictator who was working for the interests of everyone in the family. That there was the possibility that children might not conform to this pattern, that there were rotten kids. But there wasn't really any space for conflict, marital conflict. And admittedly, it was marital in those days because that's what seemed to happen in America. And I think if you go back to when Becker wrote his treatise on the family, and even before, you know, there was a very sort of, it seemed to be a very homogenous society, didn't it? People didn't cohabit, they didn't seem to cohabit, even if they really were. So, these bargaining approaches really allow almost anything to influence what happens within a couple. So, what happens within the household depends on your alternatives outside. If you have a high wage, for example, women who earn a high wage, even if they give up work, have more power in the household because their options outside the household are stronger than women who don't earn a high wage. There's also the possibility to include social norms in this bargaining framework. Of course, you can only include social norms in a rather binary way, but in some way you can incorporate social norms into this framework. So the work of Mansour and Brown and McElroy and Horney was actually, you know, quite revolutionary in its time. So another sociological approach is about the performance of gender roles. And I think that we know that with women's massive entry into the labour market, that actually things don't really seem that different between couples. There's still, you know, a strong... I mean, maybe it's different in Scandinavian countries, but I don't know, you can tell us. But the performance of gender roles, we have these neo-traditional couples. Women, you know, they work, but when they have children, if they have children, they work part-time. So there's still this hegemony, the male breadwinner ideology, that, you know, even with women's participation in the labour market. So in this study, one of the things that, when I was looking through what women had said, one of the things that really struck me is, you know, I think is better said by Foucault, and it is that there is not one, but many silences, and they are an integral part of the strategies that underlie and permeate discourses. So I thought this was very interesting, because we hadn't actually set out to study this topic, but it was interesting what women said and what they didn't say. And what they didn't say, you know, was in many ways very revealing. Okay, so I want to get on to, you know, presenting some of the findings, and then, if there's time, go back to think about how they might relate to some of the theories. So, you know, to start off with a, you know, rather uncontroversial thing, I mean, one of the, Valerie Oppenheimer, in her in a very critical work, said that actually male labour market instability is causing a revolution in the United States, was causing a revolution, and actually, to mitigate risk, couples needed to have two incomes because men were quite likely to lose their jobs. Well, I think that is true in some couples, but we looked only at women who had been in professional and managerial jobs, so they were in a rather privileged position. So this woman, who had been an investment banker, was talking about her husband and about her, him wanting her to continue in work when they had children. And she says, he thought you went a bit doolally if you didn't work. And I kind of went back by default. It was well paid and I could do part-time. When we had our second child, his view had completely changed. It was like, oh my God, no. It was at that time that Fred got chickenpox that we changed. I took some time and David took some time, that's her husband, and then we thought, this isn't sensible because we're putting David's job at risk, putting him under extra stress, not simply one of us. So one of us is obviously her. But I think it's very interesting that the way that women construct this sort of priority, whose career takes priority. So I want to go on because I've hardly got any time left. And yes, I obviously just decided last night that Fred was a good name to replace everyone with. So, you know, they're not all called Fred, I have to say. But this is a different woman who was in product development research. And she says, it was quite weird because me and Fred were both at the same stage in our careers, sort of on the same pay, you know. We were both quite equal. So I don't know, you know, I hope I would still continue. But actually, it hasn't worked like that at all. And actually, his career has totally taken off. He's at a totally different level from me. But the interesting thing about this case is that her partner was not actually in a very secure job, unlike the previous example where he was earning lots of money. This man was in and out of work. But she, in a way, still privileged his career. And she says, and I'm not resentful of that. But definitely, I've given up the whole sort of, you know, if I start something else, I'll be starting afresh again. Not that it doesn't mean I haven't got transferable skills, you know, but in a way, I do feel a little bit like, actually, in retrospect, it's a much bigger thing to give up than I actually anticipated. And I think that for many of the women, they weren't really talking. I found it interesting and perhaps quite remarkable that none of these women were really thinking about, you know, what's going to happen long term. What if I divorce my partner? They weren't really thinking in that way. Or what are the, you know, costs of my current course of action? So she goes on to say, his career is doing really well, especially this time, although he's freelancing. He's doing stuff for an international channel. He's working in TV, which is brilliant, you know. It's not just whatever job he was doing before, which would reveal him. So I feel like he really has to do this because it's going really well. I would never stop him, actually, unless I was desperate. So she would never stop him, but she doesn't really. She doesn't sort of privilege her own position. In a way, that would be, I think, you know, maybe this is part of the sort of moral valuation, isn't it? That it would be wrong to do that.
So I was very struck by this other quote by someone who was working as an EU lobbyist, and her partner was also working in, she was working in Brussels, he was working as a solicitor. And I was very struck when she started telling me this. She said, his job isn't, she was telling me, my husband does something that is really important and it's critical that he does it. And I was so, you know, taken by this. And I thought he must be a brain surgeon. He must be, I don't know, something. And she says, his job is not predictable. The law, society, code. It would be unethical for him not to do the work in matters of justice at stake. His professional code requires him to be dedicated to his work. The only way for him to change would be to change his job. And that would mean a drop in pay. And, you know, I found it incredible. He's a European competition lawyer. You know, matters of justice at stake. Well, you know, in many ways, okay. But, you know, is it so critical? To me, maybe not. So there's a strong, you know, there's a strong text of social norms going on here. You know, really, I think that women are acting in accordance with these unspoken social norms, which are also contested. You know, there's on the one side, the yes, women should work, they should look after themselves. On the other side, no, they should do what they're naturally meant to do. And so, you know, I think that these social norms are extremely powerful, actually, in the decision-making. They're not spoken of, but there's a sort of inevitability that many of the women that we interviewed sort of expressed in relation to their partners, that the privileging of their partners' careers. And, you know, it's not all, I wouldn't say it's all altruism, but I think that, you know, perhaps I shouldn't bring out the name of Talcott Parsons here, but he wrote an interesting paper in 1955 in which he said, you know, this whole societal fabric is going to break down if women don't find prestige in their partners' occupations and if they want personal prestige for themselves. But I think it's quite revealing that still, you know, women who've had successful careers can still find this prestige actually through male partners. So I will end here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, questions for Shireen?
Can you tell us a little bit about how you put this together with the findings from the work on organisations as well? I mean, how do you see the relationship between the two aspects of your research? Because you started out looking at like what the workplace is like to go back to after you've had kids and how unwelcoming or how difficult it is, and that as an explanatory factor.
I think they definitely go together. And, you know, many of the women that we talked to had been very discouraged when they went back to work. You know, they were surprised at the way that they were treated. And, you know, we do see in much of the research that there's a motherhood wage gap, that mothers are treated differently, more is expected of them. In a way, they have to prove themselves, you know, to prove that they are not the unreliable workers that everyone thinks they are. So I think it does go together. And one of the things that's interesting is that quite a few women related what happened when they said that they were leaving work. And it was interesting that their male bosses then said things like, yes, yes, you're making the right decision, or, oh, my wife stays at home, and therefore that's the right thing to do. And so, you know, it's kind of reinforced at home, and it's also reinforced at work, this idea of what's the appropriate way to behave.
Yeah, thanks for that. I suppose I was a bit surprised at the examples that you gave us where the women were so kind of acquiescent in the idea that their male partners would get prestige and that that would be conferred indirectly on them and on the household. And especially that, you, if I understood correctly, you were looking at some women that have been in high-level positions. And I'm aware that in other work there are other kinds of voices. I wondered if in your research there were more feminist voices, more kind of real points of conflict or contest that challenge that kind of idea that they should accept this pattern.
Yeah, I think there were. I mean, acquiesce is a good verb, I think, because I think that, you know, there was a remarkable level of acquiescence, I thought, given that all these women had had jobs and had gone back to jobs. It wasn't that they couldn't go back. They had actually gone back. But I think the experience, I think, you know, as a culmination of things, the experience of going back, trying to balance it all. And with the first example, with the woman, you know, where they have a chicken pox example, it, you know, it's all stress. It's stress for him and it's stress for her. But, you know, really, those experiences of that kind of stress and trying to manage it all, for many women, seem to just tip them over the edge. You know, they were in quite demanding jobs and they didn't really have a lot of flexibility. They had to be at their job a lot of the time. I mean, there were, I mean, I should maybe bring out more of these counter examples, I'm thinking, actually, in response to that question. But there seem to be so many examples of women being surprisingly silent, actually, about their partners. Because I think that there's a lot of, you know, maybe it's all about this script of relationship and romanticism and love. And, you know, they seem to be very supportive of their partners. And they did blame the organisations for what happened. But I didn't really get the sense that many people were blaming their partners.
If you look at divorce rates amongst women in high-level positions or women without children and unstable partners, maybe that gives you a bit of a different picture.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, from the divorce literature, women at higher levels of education have lower rates of divorce. So, you know, this may also contribute to a feeling of stability, which I thought this was interesting. Why don't they think about their financial future? But I thought that was remarkably absent. I mean, it may be the sample that we had, but I didn't really find it.
Yes, I was thinking about that quite a lot as you were going along, because there obviously is a cadre of women who are the opposite of this. They are the sole breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
But I think perhaps it's because the trigger for your study was back to work, whereas there are many women who avoid what they're legally entitled to. And I mean, we all know these sort of folk stories about the woman who is pregnant and she's working from the hospital bed while in labour and sending documents off to those. I've actually worked with women who are like that.
Mm.
But also very senior women who are the sole breadwinner and don't take sick leave, don't take any kind of leave at all because of almost the precarious nature of the fact that everything rests on them. So I think in a way maybe that group of people will never find it into your study if the trigger is back to work.
No, absolutely. You know, this is a group of women who are who were in professional managerial jobs and who left them.
That's
and
right.
I think in other work that I've done, I mean, I have found that being a breadwinner is, you know, main predictor of whether women stay in full-time work after having a first child. And it's actually relatively rare to go back to work full-time and stay in work for the first 5 years after your first child is born. I can give you the figure, but it isn't a common experience.
I was interested in the absence of any story about paid childcare.
Yeah, I mean, most of these people were, I mean, some of them, a lot of them did talk about childcare. And the woman who was talking about her partner being the EU competition lawyer said, well, you know, we could have 24-hour childcare. And I thought it was interesting that she then went on to say, we decided we wanted to be good parents to our children. And, you know, we deciding that involved her staying at home and her partner, you know, working crazy hours. So so I think there was a lot, you know, they were not so, I mean, some of them were financially constrained, but many of them were not really financially constrained. So it was a choice about whether you wanted to have all this childcare, not whether you, and there were a few people who actually couldn't afford it. And for them, it was more a choice of whether it would make sense to continue. But for most of them, because they were in this privileged group, they could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's just, I'm getting curious coming from Scandinavia, and it's completely unrecognizable to me. I don't think I've ever heard of an educated woman actually not going back to work to if it would be for anything, it would be for the sake of sort of everything that goes into a kit. But I don't remember ever hearing of it. So could you put a number on it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I did some other work looking at what keeps mothers in full-time employment. And I used the Millennium Cohort Survey looking at mothers who had their first child. And about 30% of women exited the labour market completely after, you know, 9 months after having their first child had exited. And there's a lot of mobility in the first 5 years after having your first child. There are a lot of flows into work and out of work, and quite a high proportion. I think only 20% of women go back to work full-time. And about 30%, you know, that survey was conducted in the millennium, so that's 15 years ago. But the women who we interviewed in this study had their children, their first children, around that time. So it sort of fits in with that pattern. But I think that, you know, quite a lot of, I mean, I think that if you really look at the data, things have not changed that dramatically in the UK. I mean, they have, because women weren't working in the early 1970s, they weren't working the way they are now, but they are working in rather neo-traditional ways.
The last question from last
time. Just a further comment on that. I mean, again, Denmark, Sweden, and I mean, our society is built upon two breadwinners.
Mm.
It's very, very few people who can afford continue the same standard they have because of taxes and so on, right? And I'm just thinking of this, is that, you know, people are not rational, and especially not about economics, even if you have a higher education.
Yes.
Very nice to take time off, not having to stress, right? Be with your kids. You don't think that long. It's a stressful job, and now I can take a couple of years. I just wonder if you asked a little bit about these types
of
things.
Well, actually, I mean, I think that for many of them, it was a case of, this is so stressful, you know, it's not working, and, you know, the children aren't looked after, and, you know, we can't continue like this.
Mm.
But I don't think that once they'd left, we interviewed them once they'd left, I don't think they were thinking, oh, this is very nice.
No.
I think that they were experiencing real conflict, actually, identity conflict.
Mm.
And for many of them, work had really meant a lot. And so it was very difficult at home to be in this no man's land and, you know, try to build up a new identity for themselves. They were really struggling with that. And they, you know, I mean, one of them actually said, you know, this is a constant topic of conversation amongst the mothers. You know, what are we going to do? How are we going to go back to work?
I was just curious. I've seen my sister go through this, the decrease in income. So she kind of values, she calls it the loss in income phenomenon in her family, where she had to give up her job to move with for her husband, and she does the same thing as you do, as you're saying, like she kind of reconstructs the value of family, and she doesn't have children, but you know, the value around money, especially income that's coming in. Do they kind of reconstruct what money and wages actually mean to the family?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually quite interesting about wages, because, you know, several of our people we interviewed said, well, you know, we started off where we earned equal amounts, and, you know, we had a really equal relationship. Yes, we had a really equal relationship. And, you know, they all say their husbands are very egalitarian in their attitudes. But, you know, there came a point where their incomes and their partners, their male partners' incomes, just diverged. You know, the woman who was working as an EU lobbyist, you know, her partner became a partner in a law firm. Suddenly he started earning this stratospheric amount, and it just didn't compare with her income. So for them, you know, there wasn't even an issue really of loss of income, because they had this really high earner. So several of them had this situation where they had a very high earner. But there were others, and these women said, well, you know, their partner's jobs were also uncertain. And so they were sort of feeling, well, maybe at some time I might have to go back and pick. But they were really trying to support their partners to have a successful career, which I thought was interesting, that they're putting all this work into, you know, it reminded me of this sort of D.H. Lawrence novel, actually, where, you know, the women are really supporting the men, you know, pushing them out the door, getting them ready so they can go out and do these nasty jobs. I mean, these men weren't doing nasty jobs, but there's a lot of woman work going on to make sure that they could keep him their work.
Thanks very much, Hiray.
So, whilst the next speaker is preparing...